From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from the WABE studio in Atlanta, Georgia. This program is made possible in great part by you, the generous support that you give to us, our listeners. We don't take you for granted. Today, as the world around us changes in unsettling and unexpected ways, it's more important than ever to provide this platform for thoughtful, respectful dialogue and voices that all too often go unheard. For more information on how you can keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, the Muslim holy month of Ramadan continues until June 24th, and sundown on the 30th starts the Jewish observance of Shavuot. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, a congressional hearing with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos brought clarity to the question of what discriminatory policy would it take for a school to have its federal education funding cut? The Cliff Notes version, there is none. Discriminate away. The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals this week upheld a lower court decision blocking the Trump Muslim travel ban. The ruling from the 13-judge panel stated that the ban, quote, drips with religious intolerance, animus, and discrimination. And in a blow to any vestiges of civility, at least as painful as the blows he inflicted on a foreign journalist, Craig Gianforte handily won a special election for Montana's lone congressional seat. Charged with assault on Wednesday, on Thursday, the billionaire Republican beat his country singer opponent by 6 points. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
Here you can see the President and First Lady of the United States inside the Sistine Chapel. Up on the ceiling, the famous Michelangelo, where you see the hands of God.
The Last Judgment.
Exactly.
As part of his whirlwind overseas tour, Donald Trump met with Pope Francis in the Vatican this week. Photographs resulted, but was anything of substance discussed? I'll ask Father James Martin, who recently received a papal appointment to the Vatican Department of Communications.
We have an election. Karen Olivito, 88 votes, 100%.
The case of openly lesbian United Methodist Bishop Karen Olivito is a complicated one. On the one hand, this past April, the highest court of the United Methodist Church acknowledged her being in violation of church law on homosexual faith leaders. Then on the other hand, the court decided this past April to take no action and to leave the case in the hands of the denomination's Western jurisdiction. On this week's show, you'll meet the clergy person at the heart of this controversy, Bishop Karen Olivito. But first,
two bills that could do serious harm to LGBT parents and kids.
Texas House passed a bill today that would allow state-funded adoption agencies in Texas to refuse applicants trying to adopt or foster children based on religious beliefs.
Let's be very honest and clear here. This amendment is the bathroom bill. And the bathroom bill is an attack on transgender people.
While it's impossible not to focus much of our attention on pressing national and international stories, many things are also happening at the state and local level. Such is the case with recent actions by the Texas State Legislature, which threaten LGBT families to a degree we haven't seen elsewhere. There's also a Texas-sized bathroom bill seemingly designed to cause as much harm as possible to transgender Texans. At the forefront of those and other state issues is the nonprofit Texas Freedom Network, and I am delighted to welcome its president and executive director, Kathy Miller. Welcome back to State of Belief.
Thanks so much for having me, Welton.
Let's begin, if we could, with you just giving us a brief summary of where things stand with the adoption bill first. What makes it even worse than similar proposals we've seen in other states?
Both our House and Senate have passed, and it awaits the governor's signature, a bill that would allow child welfare providers to be exempted from any negative actions by the state if they refuse to provide services based on a sincerely held religious belief. So that means a license for an adoption agency can't be rescinded. It means that children can't be taken from a foster home. It means the state can do nothing to intervene if a child welfare provider says that what they're doing is acting on their sincerely held religious beliefs, and that includes refusing to allow same-sex couples to be part of their adoption process, to become foster families. It also includes foster families that refuse hormone therapy for a transgender child or birth control or even emergency contraception for a child in their care.
Gosh.
Yep, it's quite bad. It covers virtually every aspect of child welfare. And because Texas does have a child welfare crisis, I think that that crisis kind of pushed people to swallow using religion as a license to discriminate. And it's deeply disturbing and sets terrible precedent for other states.
Kathy, whom is the legislation pandering to?
You know, it's really interesting. Since the Obergefell ruling on the Supreme Court 2 years ago that recognized marriage equality for same-sex couples, there's been a kind of fevered pitch from the far right to chip away at any sense of equality that LGBT Texans might have, to almost make the marriage equality as meaningless as possible. Almost to say, like, we may have to give you a marriage license, but we don't have to recognize your marriage in all of these other ways. The clear target of this legislation is allowing religiously affiliated organizations to discriminate against LGBT folks, but the harms that can occur run the gamut from discrimination based on religion. A Christian organization could refuse to allow a Jewish couple to participate or a Muslim family to participate. It can be based on sex, so you can discriminate against girls. It runs the gamut, and the harms are real and very tragic because the kids and child's welfare are already in incredibly vulnerable situations.
What about the anti-transgender bathroom bill? How similar is this to the controversy we saw play out in North Carolina?
Believe it or not, the lieutenant governor of the state of Texas declared passing a bathroom bill as one of his legislative priorities, as if, you know, roads and schools and health care weren't important. The Senate very quickly, under Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick's leadership, passed a bill that was basically saying that transgender folks could be prohibited from using any government facilities that they were most comfortable in. The House has been fairly adamantly opposed to such legislation, but under the threat of a special session just for bathrooms, the House passed a kind of modified version that was just about public schools, and it was just about providing a separate facility for anyone who felt uncomfortable using bathroom or shower facilities that were assigned for them. But the lieutenant governor said that wasn't enough discrimination. Merely allowing discrimination wasn't sufficient. He needs the state to require it.
I'm almost scared to ask you this next question. Are there additional legislative proposals on the radar that you're really worried about right now?
This legislative session, at least two dozen anti-LGBT bills were filed. More than a dozen of them were allowing religion to be used as an excuse or a license for discrimination. Most have not made it through. However, on four sunset bills, checking the pharmacy licensing and the nursing licensing board and the bar association and the bar licensing folks, they added religious freedom amendments that are being, we hope, stripped out in conference committee. But what we have seen is a tremendous effort to, in a very piecemeal way, whether it's pharmacists or nurses or in child welfare, in judges and lawyers, in a piecemeal way, to radically redefine our centuries-old understanding of religious freedom and allow it to mean that religion can be used to harm people mm-hmm. and can be used as an excuse for discrimination. And I think we spend a lot of time talking about how awful this is as public policy, mm-hmm. but I also think it's really damaging for faith to have people asserting in the name of religion, and in this case it's almost always in the name of Christianity, that discrimination is a goal. I think that harms people's understanding that faith is about bringing communities together, not dividing us.
What's going on? I mean, in the legislature, is there enough of the anger at reason, or is this coming from a stronger religious political right that's encouraged by the political climate that we're in nationally? Where is this coming from?
I do think that the far right feels emboldened by the outcome of the national elections. They no longer fear that a federal justice department or a president will intervene in their efforts in the states. So I do think they feel emboldened. We have decades of the Republican Party in Texas being hijacked by religious political extremists, and so winning the Republican Party primary is all you need to win statewide election in Texas. It's all most of our elected representatives need to win in the general election in their districts, especially after redistricting. So it's a very tiny percentage of voters in Texas that are really driving this effort in our state legislature. The Republicans are afraid that they will be primaried by the far right if they don't kind of march in lockstep. And then the final piece that I think is happening, Welton, is that the new generation, the millennials, right, mm-hmm. they are the most open-minded about issues that seem controversial today, like LGBT equality and like reproductive rights and justice. And there's a fear that in the South, in the Bible Belt, where all of these efforts have taken hold, that the electorate is changing, and it's kind of a rush to pass as much of the agenda of the far right as possible before the tide turns in the electoral arena.
Hmm. Do you think there's a kind of outrage overload that's starting to affect some activists and other people as this kind of lawmaking just keeps happening again and again? Or are you encouraged that people are continuing to push back?
Both. I'm not sure it's overload as much as a new normal. Like, people go, yeah, that's just how it is now. You know, you kind of get used to these things happening. We saw a tremendous outcry against the bathroom bill in North Carolina. But national attention to what happened here in Texas and the NCAA and the athletes and the celebrities, that didn't happen quite as much here because people get kind of numbed to what's going on. They kind of think, wow, this is just a new normal. And that's very, very dangerous. And that is of great concern.
Mm-hmm.
But we are a grassroots organization. We believe that the most meaningful and lasting change in our society comes when people lift their voices to demand the changes that will benefit their daily lives. And I've been encouraged to see a very vocal religious progressive voice in these LGBT battles. In fact, you know, dozens of clergy showed up for events at the Capitol to sing and to just hold signs that said, "My faith doesn't discriminate." And they've written op-eds and they've been very, very present in this conversation. More than 200 religious leaders across the state of Texas have signed a letter opposing any LGBT discrimination in the name of faith. So I've been very encouraged by that.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I think I'm most encouraged by, we're talking about LGBT discrimination, but this legislative session in Texas has been among the worst ever for civil liberties across the board. We've passed legislation banning sanctuary cities. We've passed even more restrictions on access to abortion care and reproductive health care. It's been incredibly challenging across the board, but what I'm seeing is different issue-based organizations, people who care about various issues linking arms and coming together and speaking with one very loud progressive voice. And I think that joining together in that way and standing for one another and being allies in protecting civil liberties for everyone is what is called for during these times, both at the national level and in the states.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm encouraged to see it happening pretty organically here.
Kathy, how can listeners to this program get involved in the work that you're doing?
We have a website, as you might imagine, and Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. So if you are so inclined, go to tfn.org and like and sign up for our notifications and alerts. We will keep folks more than informed about the happenings here around religious freedom and civil liberties and public education, too, which is one of our issues. And I wouldn't be worth my salt if I didn't say, you know, donations are always welcome. But really, we need people to pay attention. The religious refusals, right, the new plan to use religion to discriminate, we need the nation to speak up. And we need people of faith to speak up and to really say that's not what my faith taught me. Like, the golden rule has been thrown out the window. I've been hoping that the nation would turn their eyes to the discriminatory actions of Texas, and I'm still hopeful that they will. So that's my plea.
Kathy Miller is President and Executive Director of the Texas Freedom Network. Follow their work on the anti-gay adoption bill, the anti-transgender bill, and any number of other outrages at tfn.org. Kathy, they say everything's bigger in Texas, and I guess that goes for attacks on minority communities, too. I'm so grateful for you and what you do and that you're willing to be with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. You're very kind, Welton.
Much has been written about the president's overseas trip this past week, including his visit to the Vatican. Beyond the headlines regarding the climate change encyclical and puzzling photographs of a scowling Pope Francis, what do we need to know about this visit? Joining me right now is Father James Martin, a Jesuit priest and prolific author, whose forthcoming book addressing the Catholic Church and LGBT persons titled Building a Bridge. It's due out in just a couple of weeks, but he was also recently appointed as consultor to the Secretariat for Communication at the Vatican, and it's in that role that I want to talk with him first. Jim, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks. Great to be with you.
So, what are your thoughts on the presidential visit to the Vatican?
Well, I think it was largely successful on both parts. I would think that the Pope thought it was successful and President Trump thought it was successful. I think the Pope was very clear in what he wanted to say. He did that quite symbolically by giving him a gift of a sculpture of an olive tree and said that this symbolizes my desire for peace and I hope that you might be an instrument for peace. And President Trump said, you know, I want peace. He also gave him a copy of his encyclicals, including the one on the environment, which is, you know, near and dear to his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that President Trump came away feeling like he was able to spend time with a great moral leader. So, you know, on the whole, I thought it was pretty successful. I thought some of the commentaries of the pictures were kind of funny because the Pope generally doesn't look cheerful in formal photos, you know, no matter who he's with. So, you know, but overall, I thought it was fairly successful. Friends of mine in the Vatican say that initially it was quite tense, I would say, because the two men didn't know one another. And, you know, Trump had called him disgraceful earlier in the presidential campaign. And Pope Francis had said that anyone who wants to build walls instead of bridges is not a Christian. So apparently it warmed up. So that's the first thing to know. The second thing is that, you know, really you can find pictures of him looking serious with President Obama, you know, in the past. But actually, I think a more telling indication was when he was with President Obama, I think the meeting went for something like an hour, and it went for, really, the formal meeting went for 20 minutes with President Trump. And there were real sort of belly laughs when he was with President Obama. So I think that the two men, that is Obama and the Pope, were probably a little more on the same page. And, you know, a lot of it's personality, who we get along with and who we don't. But I thought that the commentary about the Pope scowling was a little overblown.
So, as you see it, probably both sides got what they wanted from the visit, and at least there's a foundation for more conversation to come if that's happening.
Well, yeah, I hope so. I really do, because I think that, without going into politics, you know, President Trump really could benefit from relying on someone like the Pope. And he said, I will read your encyclicals, and, you know, the one on the environment, Laudato Si, is very strong. And, you know, I think the Pope is the kind of person who, if Trump calls him and asks him for advice, President Trump, that is, that he wouldn't blab about it, right? And so if the Pope is able to be kind of a backdoor advisor, all the better, I think.
Well, let's go to another subject for a moment. Is there anything you can tell us about the newly appointed ambassador to the Vatican, Calista Gingrich?
Well, not much, other than she's, by all accounts, a devout Catholic. It was something of a surprise, because normally people in that role have a little bit more experience politically and, you know, are usually kind of career diplomats. The person that she is replacing is a fellow named Ken Hackett, who's a friend of mine, who ran Catholic Relief Services for many years. And so he had this vast global experience. So we'll see. You know, one of the interpretations was that he wanted to make sure that Newt Gingrich was far away and they'll be living in Rome. But I hope that's not the reason. So I was a little surprised about it, found it a little curious.
How important is that position? What does that person do there?
As any ambassador does, they represent the United States interests to the Holy See. So that would be, you know, the government of Vatican City. But it's really sort of a kind of ambassador to the Pope. They also, in my experience, my limited experience of being over there, they facilitate a lot of visits of Americans to the Vatican. So let's say that the Speaker of the House or some other senator or whatever comes over and wants to have some time with not only the Pope, but people in the Secretary of State, you know, where they have this vast experience, this worldwide experience, the U.S. ambassador would be the person to set that up.
I see.
It's an important role as a kind of conduit. And then he's also an important representative in Rome as a figure, or she would be at this point, to, you know, sort of talk about American culture, host parties and things like that. They have a 4th of July party at the embassy for all the Americans. There's a sizable contingent of Americans in Vatican City as well. Mm-hmm. So they provide a kind of home for them as well. So it's a kind of multifaceted job.
Jim, you've got a new book coming out next month. I realize it's completely unfair to try to have a brief conversation about it. But with the time we have, I do want to ask you to talk about building a bridge. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, it's about how the Catholic Church can reach out more compassionately to LGBT, that's lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender Catholics, to that community, and also how the LGBT community can interact more effectively with the Church. And it uses three words from the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and those that are words used to describe how the Church should minister to that community, and those words are respect, compassion, and sensitivity. And so I unpacked, you know, what would it mean for the church to treat LGBT Catholics with respect? What does it mean for them to treat them with compassion and with sensitivity? So it's a book about a dialogue. And then, you know, the second part of the book, which I'm just as excited about, is Bible passages that are chosen to help LGBT Catholics kind of understand their relationship to God, to the church, and then to their own self-understanding. And then I have reflection questions and meditations on that. So, you know, passages that, for example, like the story of Zacchaeus, you know, mm-hmm. Zacchaeus and the tree and Jesus, you know, offering him welcome. What can that teach us about the church? What does that teach us about how God is? And so that's just as important a part of the book. So the first part's about a dialogue, and the second part is spiritual resources.
The full title of the book is Building a Bridge, How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. Jim, what are you suggesting as possible first steps to building that bridge? And I know the three words get us there, but tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, that's a very good question. And I really think that the prime answer is listening. That for too long, the Catholic Church has really preached at told the LGBT community what they should do, how they should be, how they should act, and there's very little listening involved. So, you know, can we treat them with respect, first of all, by listening and saying, what's your experience like? You know, who are you? What is your experience of God like? What is your experience of Jesus like? Who is Jesus for you? And what has your experience of the church been like? So I think the first step is really for Catholic leaders, and by that I mean bishops and archbishops and cardinals and priests and, you know, Catholic church officials, people who work in the parishes, to really take seriously the experiences of these people, you know, who are baptized Christians, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, they're members of our church.
Right.
And so can we treat them with the same compassion that Jesus did with people who felt marginalized in his time? You know, Jesus was always going out. And one of the things I say in the book is, for too long, the Catholic Church has been about us and them. You know, the them is the LGBT community. They are other. But for Jesus, really, there's no us and them. There's just us. And so can we move towards a church where it's us?
It's a rather different dynamic today than it was over the many years you've been advocating a less confrontational approach around LGBT issues within the church. What's been the response from the hierarchy?
Cardinal Kevin Farrell, who is the head of the Vatican's Office on Family, Lay People, and Life Issues, endorsed the book. Cardinal Joseph Tobin, who's the Archbishop of Newark, endorsed it. Bishop Robert McElroy of San Diego endorsed it. And privately, other cardinals have told me how happy they are about the conversation. So, honestly, it's a sea change. And two things have happened. One, Pope Francis, you know, he even uses the word gay, which had never been used before by a pope or Vatican officials. He said, who am I to judge if, you know, a gay person is living a good life, trying to live a good life? And the second thing is the people that he's put in these positions. So the two cardinals I just mentioned, Cardinal Farrell and Cardinal Tobin, were both Francis appointees. And so he's changed the tone, and he's also changed some of the personnel. So it's really a dramatic shift. I mean, 5 years ago, I would have never even been able to get this book approved for publication. And now I have these two cardinals endorsing it.
You know, Jim, there is certainly a great ministry to the LGBTQ community. I've done it in my own ministry of trying to explain why there is misunderstanding and hate and those kinds of things. There's also, in my mind, a continuing ministry to people who are so close-minded about this whole subject. I'm just curious, where do you think that comes from? What is it about sexuality that gets the church all tied up and then usually comes out in being anti-whatever the issue is?
Oh, man, another great question. I wish I could answer that in a brief moment, but I think a lot of it is fear. You know, as St. Paul said, perfect love drives out fear. And I always say that perfect fear drives out love. And so it is essentially, to my mind, a fear of the unknown, you know, for straight people, a fear of something that's unfamiliar, You know, a lot of it, I think, is, you know, sort of church teaching that I think is kind of misconstrued. And so this prevents people from listening, and it's really rampant in the Catholic Church. I find people, they don't even want to use the word gay, even though the Pope's used it. They don't even want to use the words LGBT. But I think it's a fear of the other. And, you know, if we look at the Gospels again, always go back to the Gospels, Jesus is continually reaching out to people who are seen in that community as other. So, for example, you know, lepers, people with skin diseases, the sick, the Samaritan woman, the Roman centurion, tax collectors. I mean, his ministry is continually going out to people who are really beyond the pale. And in the church today, at least in the Catholic Church, it is the LGBT community that has that role. And so I think if Jesus were here, he would be going to LGBT people and trying to make them feel welcome. So I think it's a really important ministry. But you're right. There is a ministry to that group of people. And the third group, frankly, are the parents and grandparents and family members of these LGBT people. That's been the great revelation for me, that it's not just a ministry to a very small group of people. It's actually a ministry to a large group of people when you consider their families and friends.
Father James Martin is a Jesuit priest who has recently been appointed consultor to the Secretariat for Communication at the Vatican. He is the longtime culture editor of America Magazine and author of numerous books, including My Life with the Saints and, coming next month, Building a Bridge: How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into a Relationship of Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. Jim, it's always great to talk with you, and thanks for taking time to be with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Always a pleasure, my friend. Thank you very much.
There are religious denominations in the United States that recognize LGBT persons as bearing special gifts from God and embrace their participation in membership and leadership roles. There are also denominations that seem to come close to building their entire theology around the condemnation and rejection of LGBT persons. And now, the confusing case of an openly gay Methodist bishop has been making headlines, and I am very grateful to be joined right now by Bishop Karen Olivito, a leader in the Western District of the United Methodist Church. Bishop Olivito, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's good to be with you today.
I'd like you to begin, if you would, by giving us just a brief description of your ministry. As I understand it, you were elevated to bishop with full knowledge of your sexual orientation. So how did we get from there to where we are now?
Well, I've been in ordained ministry since 1982 and went to San Francisco in 1989 hearing a call to do campus ministry because I felt that we were missing a couple of generations, haven't reached them with the gospel. And while there, was invited to take a church, even though my membership was in the New York Annual Conference. That church wanted an openly LGBTQ person. Mm-hmm. They knew I was a lesbian. And I did what I knew as a good United Methodist person does. I went into the closet when I became their pastor. And they sat me down and they said, "No, that's not what we want of you. If you're going to be our pastor, we want you to be your most authentic self. Mm-hmm. So we want you to be fully you. And we have your back." And it was a powerful ministry we shared for 12 years, and I'm very grateful for their challenge. The West has a different understanding of diversity and celebrating diversity than I think the rest of the United Methodist Church, mainly because we are a highly diverse jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And so we've come to see God at work in people's lives who are different from our own, and see that when we come together in all our diversity, we begin to see the face of God more clearly. So I've been out since 1992, and it's not been an issue. I've just been able to do my ministry, live fully, authentically, And I struggled with the call to the episcopacy for a number of years. Mm-hmm. Many people saw the gifts and graces in me for that position, and I knew where the larger church stands. And I didn't want to be harmed, and I didn't want to harm the church I love dearly. Mm-hmm. But then God's call was just too great. I really think that at this moment in time, the gifts I have, the fruits that have been evident in my ministry would bring something to the role of the episcopacy. So, mm-hmm. So I said yes. You know, we run a very democratic way of doing our elections. So there were 9 of us who allowed our names to be lifted up, to be considered. It was a very prayerful experience, a real experience of discernment, as all of us, the 9 of us, as well as all the delegates, really sank into prayer and saying, you know, what does God require of us in this moment? And I was on the 17th ballot, elected 88-0. At once I was elected, another jurisdiction, a member of another jurisdiction, brought forth a question of law asking if a self-avowed practicing homosexual who's in a legal marriage can be nominated, elected, consecrated, and assigned. And yeah. So that went to the Judicial Council, which just happened in April, and they ruled that, in fact, the nomination, election, and assignment stood. Mm-hmm. They had questions about the consecration, but admitted that I was an elder in good standing, which is the requirement to be considered a bishop. But what they did was they stretched our definition. We have a definition of self-avowed practicing homosexual. Mm-hmm. And that's a very narrow definition. It says that basically you tell someone you were having genital contact with a member of the same gender. Mm-hmm. And they stretch that to say if you have a marriage license, you are in fact self-avowed practicing, because what they've done is reduced our understanding of marriage, mm-hmm. which, you know, in the United Methodist Church, we talk about love, we talk about covenant, we talk about care for one another. They've reduced it now, gay or straight, to mean you're having genital contact. Mm-hmm. And so that means going forward, it will be very difficult for someone who's married in a same-sex relationship to be considered a bishop. It will also make it difficult, because we have LGBT people serving at every level of the church. We always have. Mm-hmm. I'm not the first gay bishop. I'm the first openly gay bishop. But now it will make it difficult while the United States moves forward in recognizing LGBTQ civil rights. Mm-hmm. The United Methodist Church is actually moving a step backwards from that, I think.
This just exposes, doesn't it, how broad a split actually exists within the United Methodist Church on LGBTQ matters.
You know, Welton, I think we've been split from the very beginning in 1972, when a very pastoral response to the new gay liberation movement, right? The United Methodist Church was created right after Stonewall. And as we created our social principles, there was a very pastoral response to that that said homosexuals, no less than heterosexuals, are people of sacred worth. And it was a very beautiful, it wasn't condemning and it wasn't condoning, it was very pastoral. And at the last minute in 1972, the line was added to this very pastoral statement that said, however, we consider the practice of homosexuality incompatible with Christian teaching, without any study of what it means to practice one's sexual orientation, and without any study of what Christian teaching it's based on. And that has been the hinge which upon the confusion within the United Methodist Church exists. So at one point we talk about LGBTQ people should have their civil rights mm-hmm. protected. And yet we say, however, they cannot have rights, both R-I-G-H-T-S and R-I-T-E-S, in the United Methodist Church. We're a very divided church, and we've not been able to do the obvious, and that is to say we're not of one mind. If we could say that, I think we would find ourselves in a place of healing and a place of focusing truly on our mission to make disciples of Jesus Christ for the transformation of the world.
In your instance, at least on the surface, the first division was regional. I am assuming that the issue is far more complicated than just a regional difference.
Well, what's fascinating in my experience, I have been no stranger to controversy in the United Methodist Church, but since my election and assignment, I cannot tell you, I have received boxes of emails and cards and letters, people sharing with me their story, their joy at reclaiming the church they knew the United Methodist Church could be, people sharing about their own struggles to come out, their own struggles to accept their LGBTQ children, but just all these boxes of letters saying thank you. Yeah. I've received less than 36 angry letters, which says to me, by and large, the people in the pews are in a much different place than our rules.
So church law forbids ordination of anyone who is, quote, a self-avowed practicing homosexual. You don't hide your sexuality, and you're also married. What's this doing to you and your family?
Robin, my spouse, who's a deaconess in the United Methodist Church, which is a lay order of people who feel that they are called in their profession to serve through love, justice, and service. We met at junior high church camp. So we've known each other for about 27 years. We've been together 17 years and been married for just a couple of years. We share our commitment to service and our commitment to extending God's love. And so we've stayed grounded in that. We prayed long and hard to decide, should I allow my name to go forward or not? I was really fearful. And one day we had a come to Jesus moment of, you know, if I'm feeling called to this, I need to say yes now or else let it go. And so we were sitting and chatting, and she said, you know what? Perfect love casts out all fear. And we sat with that scripture for a while. And then we said, you know what? This might be what's next for us. And we went to bed that night, got up the next morning, and heard about the Orlando Pulse nightclub shooting, where dozens of LGBTQ, largely Latino, Latina folks were murdered in a shooting spree. And actually, that confirmed for us that it's time for an LGBTQ voice to be at the table. Because the United Methodist Church has done a really good job of making homosexuality an issue and talking around LGBTQ people, but not talking with them and not having our experience of God, our commitment to walk with Jesus, our love of God's people to inform the conversation.
You know, from doing a whole lot of counseling and just also a lot of personal conversations, I know all too well how hurt LGBTQ people of faith are by exclusionary policies and actions on the part of organized religion. Who is really the ones getting hurt in this controversy?
Thank you for that insight. Because, you know, for the United Methodist Church, we have three general rules: do no harm, do good, and follow God's ordinances to stay connected to God. And so when I hear that harm has been done to the church because of my election, I have to say, what is the harm? What is the harm when, one, a whole group of people have experienced healing in this? What is the harm when I'm able to share my gifts fully with an area and share my vision for to have us move into and live into beloved community together, where the fruits of my ministry are evident? Where is the harm? And if it's just about breaking a rule, Jesus modeled something for us about rule breaking. We don't break rules without great thought and consideration of what's moral and just. But Jesus broke rules when people were prevented from their achieving full healing and wholeness. Mm-hmm. And I think the rule that was broken, those rules around LGBTQ people in the United Methodist Church is doing tremendous harm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if the only harm that we've done is to break a rule, I'm not sure if harm has really been done.
Yeah. Bishop Karen Olivito is the first openly gay United Methodist bishop. She leads the Mountain Sky area of the denomination, which covers 400 churches in 5 western states. Bishop Olivito, thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for this time together.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. There are people listening to this show today who are feeling alone and afraid. They may be at a loss to understand how the values this country presents on the world stage have changed so completely and so quickly. Or they may be incredibly angry, caught up in the cycle of rage that seems to have infected our public discourse. We hear from them every week. And we know this program and your generous support for this program makes an enormous difference. And a man told me not long ago, I don't know what I would do if I didn't get to sit down Sunday afternoon and listen to your show. And so for them and for myself, I want to say thank you. If you've heard something on State of Belief this week that you found to be helpful, I urge you to share it with others who might also benefit from hearing it. It's easy to do that. It's easy to do that on Facebook and Twitter. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. That's stateofbelief.com. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. Ray Kirstein is our superb producer. Have a great Memorial Day weekend, everyone. But be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersections of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.